You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, divisions, arguments and debate. Why the EU has been struggling to get its act together over getting through COVID-19. But could it turn into a huge opportunity to unite? Also coming up, the Director General of the World Trade Organization tells Monocle about the scale of the pandemic's economic impact.
What started as a health crisis is a major economic and social crisis as well, the likes of which we haven't seen since the 1930s.
We'll have a special interview with the Director General of the World Trade Organization, Roberto Azevedo. Also ahead.
While Belgians will be permitted a weekly get-together with up to 10 friends or relatives from mid-May or so, the infernal rider to this concession is that it must always be the same 10 friends or relatives.
Andrew Muller will tell us all the things we should know that we didn't know last week, plus newspapers from Greece and the latest news from the world of tech. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in the news. The US President Donald Trump has been derided by the scientific community for suggesting that intravenous use of household cleaning products could treat coronavirus. Meanwhile, the US Congress has passed a relief package worth more than $480 billion. China has revealed the name of its first exploration to Mars, Tianwen-1, after a 3rd century BC poem called Questions to Heaven. And the city of Rotterdam has said it will go ahead and host the 2021 Eurovision Song Contest following the event's cancellation this year. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, at a time when the world looks for unity in its leaders to guide us through this global crisis, the familiar fault lines have been exposed all too easily. Most notably within the EU, where the focus by many has been on just how divided the bloc is about what to do next. The familiar roles played by the frugal North and the so-called spendthrift South. But yesterday, the bloc's leaders dialed into a conference call to establish a huge emergency fund to protect workers and member states and to examine the creation of a longer-term recovery fund. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Anna Rosenberg, who's head of Europe in the UK at the political consultancy Signum Global, and Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson is Monocle's correspondent in The Hague. Welcome both back to The Globalist. Charlotte, can we begin with you? The numbers seem enormous and it seems like the EU is finally getting its act together.
Yes, the headline numbers that we've seen are rather large. We've had numbers of between 1 and 2 trillion spoken about. The Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, has used the 1 trillion figure, and there had been leaked statements earlier saying that it could be up to as much as up to 2 trillion, which is obviously rather large. But what we don't have other details, and this is what is crucial. We don't really know right now where that money is going to come from, how it's going to be dispersed, under what conditions, when, and who to. So while we have a nice sort of headline figure there, the problem now is bashing out all those details, and that is going to be a pretty torturous process, I think.
Anna, let's have a look at the bit more of the details. I mean, what do we know about what this enormous fund is for, and how hard was it for people to agree?
Well, quite frankly, there is no agreement yet. This is not a done deal yet. What they really agreed yesterday, they signed off a rescue package that had been agreed by finance ministers on the 10th of April. And now yesterday they really just spent some time discussing what a potential recovery fund could look like. And the EU Commission proposed this 2.2 trillion recovery fund with very little detail. And in reality, they did not agree much. They said they would continue to talk about it. So what we're going to see is firstly the proposal that the EU Commission launched yesterday to be formally launched on the 6th of May, and for finance ministers to then pick up the discussions about the details. So what do we know at the moment about the details? We know the number, something between 1.5 to 2.2 trillion. We don't know if this is going to be loans or grants. There's a very fierce debate about this. The northerners want loans. The southerners want grants, so cash disbursement, really. And then there's the key question is around joint debt. And that one hasn't been answered yet either.
So tell us, Charlotte, there has been a huge amount of coverage on how divided the European Union is between those in the north who, the frugal four and those others, and then the spendthrift south. How accurate is that?
Oh, incredibly accurate. It's been astonishing just how easily these existing fault lines, which we really saw come out in strength during the Eurozone crisis, they've just come out all over again. And the argument from countries in the South has been, well, this is a completely different scenario. This is something beyond anyone's control. You can't keep the same policies, that same attitude, when it's something entirely different. And I think that's where we have seen countries in the north, particularly the Netherlands, where I live, they came out really strongly as the bad cop, which had really been Germany's role in the past. But the Dutch finance minister really irked many of his colleagues with his attitude, keeping up the same attitude of, well, it's the South's fault for not having enough put away for a rainy day. And I think that really didn't go down very well this time. I say it didn't go down very well. It didn't go down very well on the European stage, but domestically it went down very well indeed. I mean, it's playing to a domestic audience there. And we have seen these old fault lines, but I would say at the meeting yesterday, we did largely have a display of unity. It did seem like the leaders had left the finance ministers to do the dirty work, and we saw some unity yesterday. But it's easy enough to have unity when you're not really agreeing on anything. So it's now when they try and hammer out the details of this recovery plan, which is going to be pegged to the next 7-year budget of the EU, that we're going to see the real arguments begin.
There was a suggestion that it was once again Angela Merkel who brought everybody together. Apparently her preferred wording was that it wasn't we're bailing out Italy and Spain, that we are showing solidarity towards Italy and the South, and it will continue to be shown in the future.
Yes, I think that's a typical Angela Merkel line to take in these situations. In a way, Angela Merkel is a fantastic, brilliant political player. She has been really on the side of the frugal four, but she hasn't really been doing the dirty work on that sense. She has been letting the Netherlands do that in a way for really internal domestic political reasons. It's important to remember that the Netherlands has an election coming up next year. And the Netherlands is stepping into the role of Britain in being the critical or in the guarantor of EU fiscal responsibility. So I would not overplay Merkel's role in this one here. I think that the divisions, the North-South divisions that have emerged in this particular situation are interesting because they are surprising in a way that, yes, they are not surprising historically, but we would have expected all European countries to be impacted by the severity of COVID-19 to similar degrees. But what happened was the opposite. You really saw a very clear division of North-South divide. So northern countries being less affected than southern countries for a variety of reasons. And unfortunately, that has reinforced the divisions.
Tell us a little bit more, Charlotte, of the political jockeying for each leader as they try to not just play to their international, but also, as you said a moment ago, the domestic opportunities that they have. I mean, you've talked about the Netherlands. We talk about Italy's prime minister. Clearly, he needs to show that he's sticking up for his country in Brussels. And it is not that long ago, if we try and cast our minds back to a pre-COVID-19 world, that Italy was actually showing a rather large amount of Euroscepticism.
Yes, absolutely. That is very interesting as to how this plays into the whole debate over the future of the European Union, Euroscepticism, the populist parties and nationalist parties, how they might be able to capitalize on that. In terms of the latter, right now, we're not seeing a huge surge in support for populist and nationalist parties, even though, especially in Italy, we are seeing some increase in anti-EU sentiment. So it's interesting to see how that one plays out. But certainly, when we're in the midst of the crisis, people are looking for leadership from their government. They're happy to trust their governments at the moment. So we are seeing opportunity there for sitting governments to make the most of it. But of course, if they don't get it right, in the future, there is going to be massive impact. But also, we're looking at leaders like Emmanuel Macron in France. He's trying very hard to play the European statesman role, talking about unity, really making it about Europe, which is very much what he does and what his attitude has been since he's been in power. So we are seeing interesting developments on the European level. But absolutely, I think we are seeing in the Netherlands very much playing to a domestic audience, and in Italy as well, playing to a domestic audience there. I mean, there was this big thing over the Italian Prime Minister, who managed to get some wording into the statement saying it was an urgent and needed recovery plan. So it's small things like that are taken home and claimed as big victories on the domestic stage.
Anna, these are normally arguments that take place behind doors, closed doors. We see these divisions, but tell us a little bit more about how these divisions actually may well play into the hands of the EU and make it more united. Because if you take the EU, as coronavirus is doing, to the absolute brink and the EU comes through, many will say, well, actually, this is testament to its strength.
So the EU usually does get stronger in crises. It's difficult to see that now because we're in the midst of it and there have been so many errors being committed and such a lack of solidarity and individual member states really just taking things into their own hands. But eventually, why does the EU get stronger out of this? Because there are a few realizations. Firstly, that the reason that the EU can't act quicker and faster is because there's actually too little power in EU institutions, not the opposite, too much. So they realize that actually there needs to be a transfer of power towards the EU to get us out of crisis quicker and at the next point in time. Secondly, yes, there are a lot of divisions right now, especially you were referring to Italy. Italy is a case in point. It was incredibly unstable just before COVID started to hit the country, and there was talk of early elections. As we just heard, the government actually was strengthened because of COVID-19, because everyone came together. Everyone was looking for strong leadership. But now that the crisis is starting to, people are fatigued about it, things are getting in a way, people want to get back to normal, and you have this truce, the government and the opposition falling apart again. And the Italian Prime Minister has not played this very well. He has made incredible demands that are not possible to grant by the EU. And as a result of that, you see this crumbling of the truce again. So this is something that the EU is realizing, and that the Italian leader now is in a very bad position. He needs to bring something home to sell to his electorate. And this is where the EU gets stronger, because now we are having talk about a recovery plan. Yes, there's a rise of Euroscepticism, but once you hear the EU Commission throw numbers around like 2 trillion, everyone wants to get a share of that. So at the moment when money is being distributed, you will have Euroscepticism calm down because everyone wants to be part of the recovery plan. So ultimately, things are going to get, the EU is going to be strengthened out of this, but it's going to be a little bit, it's going to take some time.
Anna Rosenberg and Charlotte MacDonald Gibson, thank you both for joining me on Monocle 24. We've just heard about the EU's efforts to build a coordinated response to the global pandemic. Let's hear now from the head of another major international institution facing the same challenge. We have a severe economic downturn on the way. Supply chains are fundamentally changed for the foreseeable future. So what does the future hold for international trade? And how does this affect medical supplies? Well, earlier this week, the World Health Organization and the World Trade Organization issued a joint statement. They called on countries to make sure cross-border trade stays open so that medical supplies can get to where they are needed the most. So to find out how the WTO sees its role in this pandemic and more, Monocle's affairs editor Chris Chermak heard from the Director General of the WTO, Roberto Azevedo. Chris began by asking him whether he's worried about countries competing against each other for medical supplies.
It is natural that when you have a crisis like this, that the instinctive reaction of governments is to protect their citizens, is protect their constituencies. That's absolutely normal. That's what we do at home. We protect our families. But this is a global pandemic. We are in a situation where something that makes sense, if you're talking about one national crisis somewhere, that is very different than if you have a global pandemic like this one, because then what you do affects the efforts of others as well. So it is worrisome because it does decrease the availability of those products that are needed more in some other places. And also it reduces the trust, I think, with the system and with the ability of countries to cooperate in times of crisis.
Well, then to that point, how do you restore that trust that you're talking about?
I think first by trying to cooperate more, trying to respond better to the calls for help that we get from here. And that is improving. There is more coordination now. Even in the G20 leaders summit, I met with the leaders of the G20 and subsequently with ministers, both of trade and agriculture. And certainly in those fora, we've been trying to make sure that governments understand that any measures that are restrictive, they should be temporary, they should be focused, they should be proportionate, and they should be notified to everybody else. Everybody else needs to know, because then they plan for the availability and the supply of essential material that they need to fight the pandemic.
Could you just explain a little what the WTO's role has been in this pandemic? What is the WTO able to do to ensure that cross-border trade remains essentially as smooth as possible in these difficult times?
Yeah, well, the first thing is to tell people that this is serious. It's important that people understand that we're not talking about any other crisis. And that's a role that the WTO and that other international organizations and institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD, and others have a duty. And not being alarmists, but being, you know, realistic and telling people, look, this is a serious problem. So the first thing we did, I mean, very recently, actually, in the beginning of the month of April, was to tell and alert to the fact that what started as a health crisis is a major economic and social crisis as well, and the likes of which we haven't seen since the 1930s, you know, after the Great Depression. Even the 2008 crisis, which was the largest we had for a couple of generations, it is actually now in our optimistic scenario. So an optimistic scenario would be to face the kind of disruptions to the economy and trade that we faced in 2008. So this is serious. It can get much worse than that. The second thing is, if this is what we're facing, what should be our priorities? What should we be trying to do? And this is something that we have been working on as well. So we're telling governments, the first thing we need to do is ensure that the engine does not break down during this period of this exceptional period, because this crisis is different from everything else we had before. You know, the engine was functioning, unlike in 1930s or 2008. The engine this time around was functioning. It may not have been tip top, but it was functioning. So you cut the fuel line and the engine stopped. But to the extent that you put the fuel line back in place, the engine should begin to resume its functioning and get us back to pre-pandemic levels. But that only happens if we take care of the engine between now and the end of the pandemic. And that is something that everybody needs to work with monetary policies, fiscal policies, trade policies that are conducive to recovery, and that we all try to minimize the damage to the economy between now and the recovery, if we want to have a recovery that is robust enough.
It's fair to say that most countries also going forward will be very focused on reviving their domestic economies in the coming months. What do you think can and should governments do to revive or proactively revive cross-border trade? And do you expect them to take those kinds of actions?
Many things. I already mentioned the fact that we need to provide the correct stimulus to get the engine ready for the recovery. I suppose that after this crisis, there will be a number of things on the minds of the policymakers. Clearly, one of them was vulnerability. people are thinking, well, we are more vulnerable than we thought, not only in terms of essential products, medical products and things like that, but also in the supply chains that feed my productive facilities. There was a lot of disruption. You know, Asia is a big supplier of inputs and components, and a lot of factories were affected in the early days simply because the producers of components in Asia were shut down. So there will be a lot of thinking on how to avoid this kind of vulnerability in the future. Things that clearly the people will be thinking about is more self-sufficiency. So, for example, in terms of essential products, medical products, supplies, there will be a tendency to see how do I ensure that I have this material when needed. Stockpiling, it's an important measure, but you cannot predict what the future crises are going to require. You may want to produce it internally, but you may find out that, you know, self-sufficiency isn't always possible. You always need some degree of inputs coming from abroad. The other thing people will be thinking about is, do I then diversify my supply chains? Do I look for other suppliers in other regions of the world, even domestically? One important thing to keep in mind throughout all this is that whatever we do, we should make sure that we don't fall into the temptation of self-sufficiency as a goal. It's just too expensive for society as a whole. It might look like a good option, but at the end of the day, it would just increase the cost of livelihood for our citizens, and it will increase, in fact, the vulnerability instead of reducing it. The more diversified the supply chain, the more safe it is. So there's a lot about, you know, a lot of thinking that we need to do, but clearly maintaining borders open and more international cooperation and diversifying the supply chains, that's the way to go.
When it comes even to supply chains, it makes sense to some degree that we are going to see shorter supply chains, perhaps even domestic supply chains instead of international ones in some cases. There has to be some positive in that, as you talked about, but how do you ensure that that does not go too much to the other extreme?
Well, the best way of addressing these things is to, particularly if you're talking about pandemics, it is about international cooperation, is to set up mechanisms that will allow the international community to respond in a proportional manner with experts who know what this new pandemic will look like, what the likely effects will be, what kind of material will be required, where are the shortages, where is the pandemic now, who is going to need it first and by how much. And then, in light of all those assessments, begin to set up a global policy of response. Now, unfortunately, we have not learned this lesson yet. In previous pandemics, this was not something that existed. In this one, we're clearly way behind. And I hope that after this one, this lesson will be learned and we'll do better preparing for the next crisis.
Speaking particularly of international organizations like the WTO that has struggled sometimes to maintain that cooperation, and also the WHO is clearly, to some degree, has been in the firing line from some countries, particularly the United States. Perhaps you could speak up for the international institutions. How have you cooperated with them during this pandemic, and why are they so important? Why should they still play a central role in issues like this?
These organizations, they're a great forum for debate, to discuss, to look at things from a global perspective. Like I said, in the very early stages of a pandemic, politicians look inward, and that's natural. That's what they do, because they have to. That's their duty, to protect their population, to protect their voters. International organizations tend to have a different reaction. They tend to look at the big picture. They look at a country that is under stress and they think, well, this country here, this is just the beginning of the story. You know, this can get much worse. And they begin to think of the systemic implications of what they're seeing before them. And each international organization is very much specialized, and they are probably where you find the most wealth of expertise and knowledge about particular aspects of any crisis that is showing up. We have an international organization for for health, for education, for trade, for finance, for everything. So they can look at that in a more dispassionate way from a global perspective, looking at the big picture, but going deep on the technicalities of that particular crisis, that particular problem. And if they talk to each other, if they coordinate, they come up with common messages. If there is one thing that you can see from all these messages that we have put out with the FAO, WCO, WHO, and they with others, etc., they all have a common thread. You know, we need to fight this smartly. We need to think of the future. We need to maintain the borders open. We need to cooperate more. And we say how and in what way, and we alert to the risks. So international organizations, they're clearly fundamental in fighting crises of this nature.
And that was Roberto Azevedo from the World Trade Organization. You can hear the full interview with the WTO head in a few weeks' time on Monocle 24. It'll be featured as part of a series of Global Voices on the Future of Our Societies, done in conjunction with the June issue of Monocle magazine. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Still to come, we find out what we learned this week about the world, and we look at the Greek newspaper headlines and the latest tech news as well. But first, a quick look at what else we're keeping an eye on today. The US President Donald Trump has been blasted by the medical community for suggesting they should research injecting disinfectant into the body to treat coronavirus. He also suggested using UV light to irradiate patients' bodies. A US official had said that sunlight and disinfectant are known to kill the virus. Meanwhile, the US Congress has approved a new aid bill of more than $480 billion. It's the fourth such relief package, bringing the total federal spending on COVID-19 relief up to $3 trillion. More than 46,000 people have now died in the US with coronavirus. China's revealed the name of its first exploration to Mars. The state media agency reports the unmanned mission will be called Tianwen-1 after a 3rd century poem. The title of the poem translates to Questions to Heaven. And the city of Rotterdam has announced it will host the 2021 Eurovision Song Contest following this year's cancellation. The Ahoy venue, where the concert was supposed to have been held this year, has been temporarily repurposed to house COVID-19 patients. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Well, it is Friday, which means that Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller has been hard at work digging out the stories that made the headlines this week and a few that we might have missed along the way. Here he is with this week's What We Learned.
We learned this week that Belgium may shortly be plunged into a ghastly Hobbesian free-for-all in which all the niceties which once underpinned the social construct are abandoned. Belgian authorities announced a tentative easing of the country's COVID-19 lockdown, but one provision of the new regimen has a somewhat powder keg-esque appearance. While Belgians will be permitted a weekly get-together with up to 10 friends or relatives from mid-May or so, the infernal rider to this concession is that it must always be the same 10 friends or relatives. Phrasebooks catering to the expatriate community in Brussels in particular may need to be updated to include remarks appropriate to realising you haven't quite made the cut. Here are specially commissioned performances of the words you'll need in French and Flemish.
Ah bon? Ah bon, bah, ça c'est sympa, hein?
And or...
Ah, ok then. Bedankt, eh?
We learned that attempts to solicit reparations from China over the COVID-19 pandemic are going to become a new ring of the American political circus. The US state of Missouri has announced that it intends to take China to court over the economic damage inflicted by COVID-19 and or the consequent lockdowns. The lawsuit was announced by Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt.
We filed it today in the Eastern District in federal court, and we look forward to the Chinese government's response. I mean, this ultimately is about...
China has responded, and much as might have been anticipated, the word absurd featured heavily. It is a truism of American politics that the AG abbreviation of Attorney General also stands for aspiring governor. And while AG Schmidt's attempt to put Xi Jinping in the dock does appear a pretty straightforward case of China baiting grandstanding in search of applause from the cheap seats, some credit where due. Last month, Schmidt went after the preposterous and serially disgraced televangelist Jim Baker, who allowed one idiot guest on his ridiculous program to shill bogus COVID cures.
This influenza that is now circling the globe, you're saying that silver solution would be effective.
Well, let's say it hasn't been tested on this strain of the coronavirus, but it's been tested on other strains of the coronavirus and has been able to eliminate it within 12 hours.
Yeah.
Totally eliminate it, kills it, and deactivates it.
Yeah.
And then it boosts your immune.
Just to be as clear as we can be, this won't work. But we learned that it can always be worse. In Madagascar, the actual president is ladling out the snake oil. Andry Rajoelina, for it is he, officially launched a locally produced herbal tea, enticingly called COVID Organics, which he claimed will cure COVID-19. He wants to make it compulsory drinking at Malagasy schools.
Tous les essais et tests de ce premier remède ont été menés et son efficacité dans la réduction de l'élimination des symptômes a été prouvée pour le traitement des patients atteints du COVID-19 à Madagascar.
Fortunately, in a country as advanced as the United States, you would never end up with the actual president shamelessly and or cluelessly flogging quack remedies during a pandemic.
And the other thing that we've bought a tremendous amount of is the hydroxychloroquine, which I think, as you know, it's a great malaria drug. It's worked unbelievably. It's a powerful drug on malaria. And there are signs that it works on this, some very strong signs.
And we learned this week, at least according to one small study of patients in U.S. Veterans Health Administration hospitals, that not only does a hydroxychloroquine appear to be of no benefit in tackling COVID-19, more patients who took it died than patients who did not. We also learned, incidentally, that it's just about possible that one reason for the United States' hapless response to COVID-19 is that the aide appointed to oversee it by U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar has a professional background largely concerned, until 2018, with the breeding of labradoodles in Dallas. One can only wonder if there has been some sort of administrative mix-up, and that somewhere in Texas right now is a talented epidemiologist wondering why he's looking after these stupid goddamn dogs. We learned elsewhere that governments are becoming enragingly inventive in coming up with ways to recover the revenue lost in the global economic downturn. In Romania, the amount raised between late March and late April by fining citizens who broached lockdown restrictions was reckoned to equal the country's corporate tax take for February. We learned that Czechs are to be encouraged to take holidays in the Czech Republic. Indeed, they won't have much option, as President Miloš Zeman intends to keep the country's borders closed for a year. And who knows, perhaps the citizens of Prague in particular will somehow struggle to survive without the stag doos. And we learned again and as usual that some people will never learn. The blessed day that a COVID-19 vaccine becomes available already looms as a stern test of the convictions of those who think they know better than the certifiable geniuses who have largely freed humankind from the predations of polio, smallpox, mumps and measles, among other terrible diseases. We learned that one holdout is already willing to declare himself, men's tennis world number one Novak Djokovic, who expressed his opposition to vaccinations in an online chat with other Serbian athletes. A couple of the sort of placatory clarifications often issued after a brisk conversation with one's sponsors have since followed, but have proved insufficient to forestall the looming punchline. More like Novak Djokovic. Am I right? Is this thing working? Etc. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, I think, Andrew. You're listening to The Globalist, and still to come on today's programme, we wrap up our series on our latest title, The Monocle Book of Japan.
There's so much confidence in print media. There's so much desire for print media. Because of that, you have so many titles, and they're celebrated, they're displayed nicely, they're revered.
You're listening to The Globalist. Let's now continue with the newspapers. We head to Greece for a browse of the nation's front pages. Monocle's Athens correspondent Daphne Karnizes joins me on the line from the Greek capital now. Daphne, welcome back. How is it where you are?
Hi, good morning, Emma. You know, things are pretty much as they are in the rest of the world, I guess. Obviously, timings are different in response to the COVID epidemic I'm talking about now. I have the Greek daily newspaper Kathimerini here with me now. And interestingly, an article reads that the Greek prime minister wants to expedite the lifting of measures, which is good news, I guess. I mean, Greece seems to be on track to exit the lockdown by early May, so in a couple of weeks. The Health Commission set up here has said that indeed the epidemic here will subside within that month. And I mean, we've been in proper lockdown here for over a month already. And I think this outcome, this announcement that the lockdown measures will start being eased is really a testament to how well the Greek government has acted, which we can certainly see from the figures too. Greece has managed to keep the deaths down to one of the lowest in Europe, definitely in southern Europe, now at 125 deaths compared to over 22,000 in Spain, for example. So I think Greece has really stood out somewhat surprisingly as an example on an international level, really, of the benefits of moving quickly. The government really managed to persuade people to take the threat seriously right from the start. It introduced social distancing measures much earlier than others. And I say surprisingly, because it could have been a very different scenario had the government not handled it so well. I mean, Greece has one of Europe's oldest populations. It's got a national healthcare system that's not great, especially after decades of austerity and a long history, really, of people not paying heed, let's say, to government orders. And not only that, but, this article is saying that, and many articles that I've read are saying that this crisis for Greece has actually acted as a chance in a way for various sectors of the state to change for the better. You know, things like digitization of various government services, modernizing the healthcare system, online education systems, and so on.
One thing that's been striking about the way that the Greeks have managed this is this text message, the 13033, I think I've got the number right, system, that seemed that explained to us a little bit about how it works and how it's been so successful.
Yes, exactly. I know that well. You're right. It is 13033. Basically all citizens have to select a code from a list. So, for example, number 2 is going to the supermarket. Number 6 is going out for exercise. Number 3 is if you have to, if you're leaving the house to go and assist an elderly person. So you have to send that code along with your name and your address to this text number, and immediately you get a reply back giving you access to leave the house. You have to obviously specify the time that you're leaving. So, if someone's a police person stops you on the street, they know that you haven't left for too long. And people have really been adhering to that. Obviously, also that works along with, in parallel to the fines that you can get if you're caught on the street having not sent the text. So it's definitely a system that worked. Of course, if, people don't have access to a cell phone or can't send a text, there is a form that you can manually fill in and print off and have with you. But definitely, I think that's been a good system in this case.
Let's move on to one of the mainstays of the Greek economy, to tourism. That, like everything else across the world, is under huge pressure this year, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. This is a really big one for Greece. I've got the newspaper Tanea here with me saying that Greece's tourism season could be shortened to 3 months, which is, of course, very short compared to the full season. Later today, the Greek government is going to be highlighting, it says here, more specific plans for bolstering and supporting businesses, especially for the tourism sector, which, as you say, is a huge pillar of the economy. And it was really what helped the country recover in the first place, along with foreign investment. Of course, tourism accounts for 1/5 of the country's total output, 25% of the Greek workforce. And of course, it has been very badly hit at the moment. You know, of course, hotels are closed. The tourist season was meant to be starting, you know, now or at the end of this month. One silver lining that has been mentioned is the fact that Greece has, compared to other countries, less COVID cases and less deaths, and has handled the situation quite well. It's trying to position itself as a relatively safe destination once people do begin traveling again. Of course, it's still unclear when international travel restrictions will lift, but when it does, it is expected to perhaps be one of the more accessible, let's say, destinations in Europe for people to travel. And of course, Emma, I've seen a lot of articles in the British press already about, you know, the most remote Greek islands to travel to, you know, populations under 500 and that sort of thing. So, I mean, of course, it's not just Greece, it's tourism in the south and the Mediterranean more generally. But I think, as I said, because Greece has just returned to growth and has just, you know, left years of austerity, I think it is particularly vulnerable.
And as a result, when we heard a little bit earlier in the programme about the European Union coming together of sorts and coming up with an aid package and long-term ideas for the revival of the European Union's economy, Greece is absolutely in need for that, for a slice of that, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, the next story I have here with me in Kathimerini talks about this meeting yesterday between the EU leaders, this summit, of course, via video conference, which is, you know, was meant to take forward the EU's response. What will their response be to the, you know, financial impact of the pandemic? And what the Greek Prime Minister said on his end, that he stressed that these recovery funds should come in the form of aid in, you know, with grants to EU member states and not loans, which is this kind of divide that we're seeing, kind of a northern and southern European states sort of divide, I guess, countries like Germany, Sweden and the Netherlands preferring to give loans. But of course, you know, this will have an impact on the debt to GDP ratio for certain countries. Of course, we saw this play out in Greece very well. So what the Greek Prime Minister is saying, that, you know, the recovery strategy, whatever it ends up being, shouldn't burden in any way the public debt of any country.
Monocle's Athens correspondent Daphne Karnizes, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now on Monocle 24 to talk tech. Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan joins me on the line. Welcome back, David. Tell us a little bit more about this news that's been moving for a couple of weeks about Google and Apple getting together to come up with a COVID tracing technology. Tell us what's the latest on it, please.
Sure. Yes, it is a remarkable, unprecedented thing. Google and Apple have not been friends for a long time since Google launched Android phones, and Steve Jobs said that he wanted to nuclear destroy it. But they have collaborated on this COVID tracking technology, and it's moving very fast. Yesterday, the Apple CEO Tim Cook told an EU executive that the app will be available for use from the 28th of April, so early next week. And it's an interesting thing. You have to download the app onto your phone. It works with Apple or Android phones, and that's it. Then you forget about it. In the background, it then monitors in actually quite an unsinister way, your movement. So if I was talking to you, Emma, and we were less than 2 meters apart, our phones, using Bluetooth, would exchange anonymized beacons. They don't have any connection to you or to me, but they mirror each other. Then if, say, a week later, God forbid, I was diagnosed for COVID-19 and positively diagnosed, you can't fake this, then my phone would contact your phone. They wouldn't know each other. They wouldn't know who they were talking to or where you were or anything like that, just to say you've been in contact with someone who has COVID, so you may need to isolate or you may need to get tested or whatever. That's essentially how it works.
Tell us a little bit about how you take two sworn enemies and make them friends, and then when this is all over, you make them enemies again.
Yes. Well, maybe, you know, the funny thing about this whole extraordinary experience is maybe things won't be the same afterwards for everyone. Maybe they won't be quite such sworn enemies. I think they recognized that one of the big problems with an app like this is you can put it on every iPhone easily or every Android phone really easily, but it's pointless. The only way it works is if a significant number of people have it. So to create an app that is on both kinds of phones takes that kind of collaboration. And indeed, the next stage is that the app won't be needed. They will be able to build it into the Apple and Google operating system, so nothing needs to be downloaded, because that's one of the big hurdles. You've got to get people to download it in the first place before it can work.
The Apple iPhone SE is out, the new one. I think many people have encountered an SE in the past. Most of us have bought one.
Yes, that's right. It was a very popular phone released in 2016. It looked like an iPhone 5, but it had a much newer processor inside. The new one that comes out today, it goes on sale in the next hour or so, it follows a similar principle. It looks exactly like the iPhone 8, which was released in 2017, but it has the very latest, most powerful processor, the fastest processor in any phone anywhere inside it. And what that means is it transforms the experience, because although it's got a three-year-old camera, because it's got a brand new processor, it's able to do what they call computational photography, to use software to improve the photographs you take, to add features like portrait mode for a blurred background and so on. And I've tested it. It's nice. It looks and feels exactly like the iPhone 8 and behaves exactly like it. It's got a fingerprint sensor instead of the new Face ID that more recent iPhones have. But it is very fast, and everything it does really efficiently, from video playback to opening apps to taking really good pictures.
Briefly, David, we're possibly a long, long way away from those days when people used to queue for hours outside an Apple store to get the new phone. But how do you actually get a phone now? And what are the sales expected to be like when we can't actually go and buy one?
Yes, that's right. That is a very big question. All Apple stores, apart from ones in China and a couple in, I think, South Korea is reopening, all Apple stores outside those countries are closed. So you can only buy online, either from Apple or from a reseller like Carphone Warehouse in the UK or one of the big ones in the States. But I think sales will be high. Obviously, they're going to be impacted. But this is... it's not quite the cheapest phone Apple has ever sold. In the UK, it's £419. In the States, it's $399. So it is certainly the most affordable. And I would say it's certainly the best value phone they've ever made. And I think those two things together will make people whose phone is beginning to die, or they're thinking they want a new phone, it's an affordable way to get a new one. So I think despite coronavirus, sales will be high.
David Phelan, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 7:51, and to celebrate Monocle's latest book release, the beautiful Monocle Book of Japan, we asked Monocle's editors to talk about some of the highlights of the book. It's out now and available to order on our website. So let's hear from Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. He talked to our culture correspondent, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, to find out what makes Japanese magazines so special.
To keep it general, I think the first and most important thing is the state of the market in Japan in print magazines. There are so many. There's so much confidence in print media. There's so much desire for print media. Because of that, you have so many titles. And they're celebrated. They're displayed nicely. They're revered. Everyone has a favorite 5 or 6 titles. They're collected. They're almost fetishized over. I wrote about it once in an essay in the Tokyo Travel Guide. And I said, if you are a chef, you should live in Italy. And if you're a fashion designer, you should work in Paris. And I think if you're a graphic designer, you have to visit Tokyo, Japan. If you're a designer for print, you must visit this place because it is a mecca for paper, print, and magazine design.
What's impressive, Rich, what I find when I read Japanese magazines is the attention to detail. I mean, in one page, you have like 6 pictures, you know, with descriptions. It's just so, as you say, it's almost like a work of art.
Yes, yeah, it's incredible. And they have a slightly different approach. And it's hard to describe. I think in the West, we are very focused on what came out of Switzerland in the 50s, which is this international style, which is this, it's a system. It's the grid system. It's about making things uniform. It was the time when sans serif typography came to the fore. And Western magazines, they tend to be very systematic, very structured, very easy to read. But in Japan, they don't follow those same sets of rules. You can go from one spread of a magazine to the following spread, and they don't correlate in the same way. Text appears in different parts of the page. It doesn't follow the same grid. It's freer. It's much more of a scrapbook approach. And because of that, you end up with this macro amount of information and detail. They fill every area of white space. There is no negative white space. It is, let's fit on everything we need to tell this story, to relate this information to the reader in whatever way it takes. And so it feels like you end up with a 250-page magazine that feels like almost like news pages everywhere. They are almost exhausting. And of course, that's why we love them. That's why we like to pore over them and take our time. They are the masters of, you know, 50 images of T-shirts, and they can kind of turn this out at an incredible rate. I dread to think the hours that are put into these magazines, because I look at it and I think if I had to produce and design in that way, it must be so labor intensive. It would be, well, you know, 18-hour days, 30 days a month, I'm sure. In fact, I'm sure it is like that.
I was wondering, Rich, I mean, did this type of design as well influence your style as well and the way you thought out of Monocle at the beginning? Because I do think there's some elements of a Japanese magazine in Monocle, not all of it. I wonder, what's your view on that?
Well, I think we are influenced. I was very lucky to visit Japan on several occasions, had Japanese clients there before Monocle started. And I think the lesson you learn from Japan, or the lesson that you ought to learn, is that to not miss any opportunities with print, to make sure you don't have to fill every element of the page, but it's about attention to detail, and don't stop when you've done what you think needs to be done. Investigate more. Look at the back of the business card or the edge of a business card. Check your logo works at X, Y, and Z sizes. Even right down to a gutter credit. Is that really the right point size, color, font? All of those things. So I think when it came to Monocle, we certainly put a lot of attention to detail into it. And we were influenced as well by color and illustration and the craft that you still see in Japan and everywhere in Japan in terms, you know, in packaging, in paper sourcing, in illustration, in the use of a brush over a mouse or a stylus. So all of that influence, that playfulness and fun, certainly filtered its way onto our pages. But I think as a product, we are still within this sort of Western international style approach. We have a grid and a structure, and you need that for branding, which of course, Monocle isn't just a magazine. We're kind of a slight hybrid, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I thought so. And Rich, in the latest, the Monocle Book of Japan, of course, there's a beautiful spread about magazines. And I was wondering, do you have any favorite titles or titles that you think it's worth mentioning, you know, to our listeners?
Yeah, well, that spread was one of the nicest things to lay out. And it's a complete homage to Japanese publishing. It's got all of our favorites. And it's not just about, hey, and here's all the amazing design Japan does. It's also about the range of subject matter. And you can go from something very established and wonderful as Popeye magazine and right the way through to a specialist magazine about camping done in a fashionable way, which is one of my favorites, which is Go Out Style. to write magazines about, you know, dogs or just every subject. And again, it's not done in a twee way. The dog magazine is something that you will buy and keep, even if you are not a dog owner, because it just is such a sort of warm and friendly approach. You can't do anything but smile. And I think that's what the Japanese newsstand does for me, certainly. And that's not just because I'm a print designer and I like magazines. It just, there's just so much there to take in. It's like a smorgasbord and Christmas Day all in one.
Rich, I have this idea because at least I am doing this, you know, during this lockdown where we're kind of working from home. Are you kind of grabbing your old copies of Japanese magazines and looking at them again? I mean, what has been kind of your media diet during this period?
Well, of course, like everyone, it's a digital diet in terms of keeping abreast of things. But one thing I'm very glad about that is in my home, I am surrounded by a lot of print media, print magazines that I've collected over the years, books, graphic design books. And prior to being forced to work at home, I would occasionally work at home just so I could reference books, you know, a little bit of quiet and go back through things. How I long to be doing that in the office now is of course the forefront of my mind. But yes, it's nice to have a good collection of books, and I'm slightly smug in saying that a lot of those books have come from trips to Tokyo.
Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There'll be more on the Monocle Book of Japan on next week's editions of The Globalist, and you can order your copy of the book now at our website, monocle.com. And if you're interested in magazines like us, tune into our print show, The Stack, premiering every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24. Well, that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Augustin Macellari, Paige Reynolds, Carlotta Ribello and Daniel Bache, our researcher, Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager, May Lee Evans. After the headlines, more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist returns at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening. Have a good weekend.